Today is February 18th. This is the first interview with Peyton Smith. We are conducting this interview in Steenbach Library inside the UW-Madison Archives. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Peyton, to help us with sound quality, could you start off by saying your name and spelling your last name?
My name is Peyton, but I'll spell my first name too, P-E-Y-T-O-N. Mm-hmm. And my last name is Smith, S-M-I-T-H.
Yeah, actually, in your case, it's probably more relevant to spell the first name than it is to spell the last name.
Everything before Peyton Manning. Now it,
I guess that's true.
With Walter Peyton, most people had my name spelled P-A-Y-T-O-N.
Right. So Peyton, you and I just chatted briefly before I turned the recorder on about some of the things I was interested in asking you today. And the first is sort of the general growing up question. We know you came to UW-Madison in the 70s, but I'm wondering if there's anything about your family life prior to that you want to get on the record.
Well, I guess I should say I grew up in Wisconsin, and I moved around. I lived in Sturgeon Bay, a small town, for 8 years. Sheboygan, Wisconsin, a small town, a little larger than Sturgeon Bay, for 8 years, and then Green Bay for 2 years. I worked a couple summers in Door County and Fish Creek in the CNC Supper Club, washing dishes, waiting, cooking, that kind of stuff. So I'm really a Wisconsin boy with strong roots through and through, mm-hmm. sort of the Midwestern values and things like that. Both of my parents attended college. My mother attended college during World War II in what she said was a woman's finishing school because her father wanted her to be educated before she got married. She taught school in Chicago before moving back to the Sheboygan area. And my dad attended college as a result of the GI Bill. His dad had died when he was 10, and he lived on the East Coast, and him and his mother and brother and sister moved back to Sheboygan where they had some relatives. So after World War II, he came back, and he always said the GI Bill was one of the best things that ever happened because education was the great equalizer, and it allowed people to go to school that couldn't go to school. Mm-hmm. So in order to get ahead in the world, you should go to college. So I grew up with an expectation that I should perform well and should go to college. That was, you know, part of the family culture. So, you know, my parents, being first generation college students, wanted me to be a college student because sort of education, I think, begets education. And there was, I believe at the time, much more of a view that public education was really the right thing to do. Right now there's a lot of debate with charter schools and this and that, but back then it was, you know, that was really very solid in our lives. So I worked all my life that I can remember, from being a cutting grass, babysitting, being a paper boy, and then started working in the restaurant business under the table when I was 14 because of the child labor laws. But I worked for some people in the business, and we'd work banquets and set up the tables and tear them down and sometimes serve, you know, family style stuff. Because as my dad said, you need to pay for most of your way through college, and my father died when I was 10, so you need to take care of yourself or you won't know what to do. So I have this kind of thing that you needed to work. This sort of probably falls into place because of the opportunity I'll explain that happened in Madison and why I jumped at it, you know, because for my first job here on campus, if you will. Mm-hmm. So a couple of really transformative things happened for me was I was a sophomore in Sheboygan North High School, and I took a debate class. There were some other civic social kind of things, but a lot of it was debate oriented. And this teacher really, really pushed critical thinking. And some of the debates that he had were on, should the United States be involved in the Vietnam War or not? Well, being a sophomore with my father fighting in World War II, I believe that we should be defending freedom and all that. But during the course of the semester that I took this, a lot of the seniors in the class who were facing either going to college or potentially getting drafted and going into the service and serving in Vietnam were researching different points of view and all that. And so I thought, well, there's a lot more to this education than some of the what I was taught in high school, which was pretty much more of a not as critical. It was, here's what we did and here's why we did it, and it wasn't this good. And I firmly believe that and everything. And so that made me think that, well, when I wanted to go to college, I wanted to really go to a place that was going to push me beyond my comfort zone of the small towns I lived in. And beyond the comfort zone, quite frankly, of beautiful place to live, beautiful environment, beautiful people and everything, but not as diverse of thought process as I wanted. So another factor for my family was that during the riots in the 1966, 67, the city riots, my mom volunteered for Head Start, and we brought children from Milwaukee and Chicago into our house for the summer to provide some relief in the inner cities. And so I was connected with families, a lot of poverty families that I had never been connected with before. My dad also played jazz during World War II, so he had a number of black friends, and when they came through town, they'd stop and see us, which was very rare because there weren't any black people living in Sheboygan, and only one family in my high school had moved in Green Bay in my last 2 years of high school there. So my parents were very accepting of different cultures and different nationalities. And my dad said anyone could be the best ditch digger or the worst ditch digger. Anyone could be the best banker or the worst banker. It didn't matter what they were. So I wanted to not go to more of a local or parochial environment from which I had already come and seen a lot of what was there. And growing up in a German community, I heard rightful things about certain cultures, and I had marched in with my mom and Father Grappi's one of the freedom marches in Milwaukee, and had a t-shirt, and where I worked in a restaurant in Green Bay, the owner's son was a good friend of mine, and his father, you know, that he hired me. He ripped the t-shirt right off my back and used some rather strong words. So, you know, I definitely wanted to put myself in a different comfort zone and try some new things. At the time, you know, Berkeley was really getting a lot of national press. Madison was getting a lot of national press. Columbia was getting a lot of national press. But for some reason, Berkeley was really where I wanted to go in Madison as a backup. And I looked into Berkeley, and I had to drop out for a year to establish residency in order to be able to pay tuition because I didn't have the capability for support. And at that point, it was the peak period of drafting because I graduated in 1969 for the Vietnam War. So I didn't want to go to the Vietnam War. You know, my father said, if you get drafted, you will go. And my mother said, if you get drafted, I'm giving you $2,000 and you will go to Canada. And my parents had this huge argument. And I didn't even discuss anything about it because it was sort of a difficult time in society. There was a lot of, you know, rejection of your parents' culture and, you know, a lot of those kind of things going on too, which to some young people was attractive. Well, I couldn't go to California, and I took a tour of colleges around the area with a church group just to see what they were like. And University of Minnesota, we went up there, and there were a lot of professors playing a Frisbee game with students, and a couple of them talked to me, and I thought, well, that would be okay. So I applied to Madison, Berkeley, and University of Minnesota. And then the tuition reciprocity wasn't coming through. Well, I had a change of heart because three of my good friends from high school were coming to Madison, and they were getting involved in the drug culture a little more heavy than I felt comfortable about. Mm-hmm. So I applied to Eau Claire, and I went to Eau Claire for 1 year first with my idea that I'd transfer down to Madison. So I took 18 credits the first semester and 17 the second to ground myself in the academics. And there was a fiscal reason. I had enough money to pay for one semester of college tucked away easily. And my dad told me he'd pay tuition and the dorm fee for the second semester. And that was it. So I would have been able to get through Eau Claire and have a little bit of money to start Madison with the, at that point, then my dad gave me $100 a month for 9 months to come to Madison. And then he left the state, and that was it. So I transferred down to Madison after my first year in the fall of 1970, clearly because I didn't trust myself as a young adult. And the Vietnam War was a great motivator if you didn't want to go. I had friends whose older brothers were there. I had a girlfriend who had a pen pal from Vietnam that she'd write every week or two, and he'd send cassette tapes back and talk about that. So, I mean, it was really, it affected so many different people, because with the draft versus a volunteer force, you know, unless you could get into the National Guard or something, or knew a senator to get some sort of deferment, you faced the likelihood of being drafted. And in the Green Bay draft pool, they were drafting a lot of, you know, people at that point. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I went to Eau Claire for a year, but I came down to Madison every weekend. From Thursday, my class ended at noon, and my classes started about Monday at noon. I stacked them up that way in Eau Claire, so I came down to Madison still to be with my friends. And did extremely well, enough to transfer into Madison, and then I transferred down here. During that time I came to Madison in the weekends was when the anti-Vietnam War was, there were a lot of peak activities. It wasn't the Dow riots or burning of the draft card kind of things, but it was the invasion of Cambodia, mm-hmm. and the shootings at Kent State and the shootings at Jackson State. And so I was down here a lot of times during those periods, and very wary the first year of running into any altercations, because since I was a student from the University of Eau Claire, and if I was in Madison and was involved in any, quote, riot, you know, I could be an outside agitator. So, I mean, I did participate in the nonviolent part of the protests. Mm-hmm. And that's significant, too, because my father told me that if I wanted to make a change, and I disagreed with my father for a lot of things, and I clashed with him, and probably that course in high school taught me to debate. So he told me if I was going to disagree or do something, that I would have to stand in the jury box and take it. If I was ever going to break the law or do anything in a protest, that I needed to, you know, stand in the box and be responsible. So that made me think that, well, you know, I'm not going to go break windows, or I'm not going to go do anything like that, you know. Mm-hmm. But I was against the war, and I thought a number. And at that time, they were just on the Library Mall. All you had to do was walk through, and almost every day there was a table with someone that had postcards to write your congressman, your senator, and, you know, say you're against the war. I mean, there was just all kinds of activity going on. Mm-hmm. You walk through the Library Mall, and if there was a, and even though I was just there on the weekends, I mean, I wasn't working. Mm-hmm. With the exception of two courses, my first year of college was relatively easy, so I did study down here a bit, but, you know, I really crammed when I was up there and paid attention to that. So I had a lot of free time to wander around. I had friends down here. And immediately a girlfriend, and that was really a magnet to come down here. Right. So I saw some of the, I spent the week after the spring, the invasion of Cambodia down here, because I was here and things started happening. So that's really, I skipped school in Eau Claire just to see it. And then I thought, I need to transfer down here for sure, which my plan was. So the next year, you know, I transferred to UW, mm-hmm. Madison. That was fall 1970. So I was a sophomore in the fall of 1970. Now, one other thing is, in the fall of 1969, when I was a freshman in Eau Claire, they had a lottery, which meant that 18-year-old males, their birth dates, they pulled the birth dates out of a drum or whatever it was, and you were given a number. And I got 186. And the draft board in Green Bay was saying that they never went above 168. So even though I transferred down to Madison here, I had, at that point, the option of not staying in college, with the fear of being drafted right away. Because if you were in college, you could get a four-year student deferment until you graduated. I interrupted you.
No, ask. No, I'm glad you added that little bit there. So, I guess first off, so you were here I think you just said you were here April, May during the April, May 1970. So, yeah. You know, sort of the end of the TA strike.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The TA strike. Yes.
Nixon escalates the war, well, announces that the war has gone into Cambodia.
Cambodia. Yeah. The bombing of Cambodia.
Right.
Shooting at
Kent State and then Jackson State as well. I guess, and you said that, you know, you're trying to avoid sort of violent confrontations, but from what I've heard about that sort of time period here in Madison, it would have been tough at least to be on campus and not be just sucked into some of that.
Well, you were tear gassed all the time, anytime you went out. Mm-hmm. And students were picking up tear gas and throwing it back at the police. The Dayton County sheriffs had tie pins on them with pigs because they were called pigs, you know, mm-hmm. And so they were mocking the students back. They had vehicles, gray vehicles with chain link fence over the windows. I mean, what happened was you'd meet at the library mall and they'd say, groups are gonna, you know, form at 6:30 or 5 and we're gonna march to here. Everyone ran home and watched the national news. Who's protesting? You know, what's going on? It was really sort of a culture like that. Mm-hmm. The students who were protesting. You got a sheet, you got these handouts that said, here's where we're gonna meet at the library mall, or we're gonna meet here, we're gonna march to here. Here's where the medical stations are gonna be. Be careful, there are people in the crowd that, you know, are not protesters, so only keep with your small affinity group if you're going to do anything. I mean, they were giving you instructions. And usually when you were marching, the front end, the front group of the march was where the confrontation and the clash was going to happen first. Mm-hmm. So I stayed away from the front, and once the tear gas started flying and everything like that, and I had a friend who lived in Celery Hall, so we could run out and hide, and I had another friend who worked at a store on State Street, and then my sophomore year I worked, so you could run and hide. We had the keys to a store on State Street, you know, that was, even though it was boarded it up. I'm sure if the owner knew, he would have been terrified. But, you know, once the tear gas and all that stuff started flying, you know, that's when you stayed out of it. But, I mean, yes, you couldn't avoid it. I am proud that I never picked up a rock, that I never busted anything. I can tell you one thing that we did do in Celery Hall. We took a break, you know, after things got tough, and we were actually watching. They were constructing Vilas Hall, so there's all these boards around it and all that. And Johnson?
Yeah.
Well, you say, okay, Johnson and Park, mm-hmm. They were building bonfires, and all of a sudden then the National Guard would come, people would run away. Then the fire trucks would come and they'd put the fire out and they'd plow the debris away, and then they'd probably go someplace else to deal with this, because there were some barricades being thrown up that were being put on fire and some of the boards being ripped down. We went into the student lounge and there was a kid in there with a slingshot with a wrist brace and some steelies. And he was gonna shoot at those firefighters. So we did take away, you know, but that was the only life-threatening violence that I saw, you know, that anything like that. I mean, you know, and then there was the Sterling Hall bombing, and that really slowed things down because that happened in August 1970. Mm-hmm. And so when I did transfer down here, I mean, the whole protest movement changed a lot because people got killed. The gravity of it was different. Mm-hmm. There was a shooting on Bedford Street. This is when, you know, then, and the Armstrong and Leo Burt and David Fine, you know, the stuff was in the paper about them having tried to make a homemade bomb and drop it off an airplane at Badger Ammunitions and stuff like that. And when you did drive by Badger Ammunitions at night, it was lit up. It was under full production. So, I mean, you saw the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. you know, if you went up into the Baraboo Hills, which... Mm-hmm. It was beautiful, so a lot of us played up there, you know, in the wintertime and in the summertime, so we'd see that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I saw the tail end of the big protests. And the funny part was I ended up working with people in a building where the National Guard had set up some observers, Space Science and Engineering Center, and working mm-hmm. with a couple of faculty later that saw the war protests from a different point of view, and also with chancellors who saw how the legislature and the state viewed the university differently after those tumultuous and turmoil-filled mm-hmm. years.
Now, Peyton, were you, well, I'll ask it this way. Do you recall where you were when you heard about Sterling Hall being bombed?
Yeah, I was on, that was, I came down in August. So I was on 900 Street of Johnson. I can't remember the address. You know, the memory is a tricky thing, so I want to say I heard it, but I can't tell you I did that for sure. Mm-hmm. What I did hear is my father called me, livid, because my grandmother was at University Hospitals, which was directly across the street from Sterling Hall, and her windows had been shattered. And so, I mean, I had to tell him a number of times, Dad, I didn't blow up the building. Dad, this isn't me. You know, I didn't do this, Dad. I mean, he was. So, you know, and my mother joked that she was going to have to give me camouflage from then on in just to survive down here. And mm-hmm. So, it was turmoil in the family. Mm-hmm. You know, And all I remember after that, quite frankly, is when everyone went to register, it seemed like people had their heads down. I mean, you know, there was a lot less talk about when the next protest was going to be, and it really took the sting out of that. I also believe, though, to tell you the truth, that the lottery took the sting out of it, because I knew a lot of students that said, I don't really have to worry about it. Mm-hmm. So.
The draft lottery.
Yes. Right. As an undergraduate student down here, so when I did come down here, I attended a couple Friday afternoon classes with my friends. They were fun, and there was no attendance. A couple of them were big. Well, a lot of the classes, I mean, there was tear gas going on in Bascom Hill, and the professors would debate the war. I mean, you know, they would talk about the issues. And it really disrupted class. And when was it? Gosh, in 1970, when I came here, either the fall or the spring, there may have been another TA striker. There was something, but all our class voted to meet at our TAA's house in order to, you know, not deal with all the disruption on campus and everything. You couldn't get your class done because there was tear gas coming in and, you know, things like that. And people wanted to talk about that. So as the group, we voted as a class. And this was a calculus level course, so it was very important as part of the requirements, but that we would go to his house off campus to attend it, and that we would agree that if we couldn't get enough homework done and enough assignments in, that we would put our names in a hat, and anyone who attended regularly and turned things in, put their names in a hat, and he'd take it from the top of the steps. He lived on the second floor of an apartment because he was a TA grad student. Throw the names down the steps, and the ones who landed on the bottom half got an A, and the ones who landed on the top half got a B. I got a B. I was very happy. Calculus level, second level. So it was second level calculus course. Probably spring semester. So I do remember that. But I did try hard. Mm-hmm. It's topics in exotic mathematics. It was just extremely fun and very difficult. Very difficult. I had a friend who was the only female in applied mathematics, physics, and engineering. And she looked at some of the gaming puzzles we had and said, these are really difficult. But I got a lot of credit for the logic, not necessarily the right answers, but following the right path. The campus was a lot different back then. You know, student activities, you could do more things more loosely and things like that. So during my sophomore year, I picked up jobs on campus. And then it's important to note that the first semester, fall 1971, I decided that I was going to go check out Berkeley and see if I'd live there for a year, become a resident of California, and complete my degree at Berkeley because I didn't have the draft holding over my head. So I took a semester off, and I went up to Vancouver, Canada, and I went to a student religious liberal conference of the Unitarian Church. And the student religious liberals, that was the high school group and then the college group, and we had a two-week conference there. And then I bombed down to Seattle and stayed at a friend's house for a couple weeks, Portland, Oregon for a couple weeks, and then I spent about 6 weeks in San Francisco and Berkeley. Well, the drug scene around San Francisco was really getting negative at that point. You know, it was negative at that point, not getting, it was. There was a lot of speed, there was a lot of desperation and all that hippie stuff a lot of people were taking advantage of, and it wasn't a cool scene. And Berkeley, while it was really neat and I really enjoyed it, I just thought I'd rather come back to Madison and complete my degree. There was just too much street activity, and to tell you the truth, the lines were too long for everything you wanted to do, you know. And so as much as I really wanted to and had the credentials at that time to get into Berkeley, I don't think I would today, but back then I did. So I came back to Madison and re-enrolled in the spring semester.
So you said you took calculus. Your degree is in comm arts. So
you had to have a mathematical, you know, you had to have a couple certain science, you had to have certain math, you had to have language. So you needed 4 semesters of language. You needed a calculus level. I only took in high school up to the pre-calculus level. You know, so those are the, that mean, you know, the, I did the minimum science credits, if you will, lab science, you know, and math. The funny part is when I applied to graduate school, my highest scores were in science and math, and those were my least courses, and my lowest scores were in English, which was, I mean, I went into journalism.
So why did comm arts appeal to you as a possible degree?
I didn't know what I wanted to do. I actually, you know, to tell you the truth, I was in theater when I was a kid, from youth theater all the way through community theater. My mom was involved, so I was in a lot of plays growing up. And when I went to Eau Claire, I was, oh, I'm going to be in theater. Well, you think you're pretty good, you know, but then, and I tried out for the first play, and I remember going, sitting in the auditions, and some guy was next to me, and he was an upperclassman. And he asked me what I was going to do there, and it was a play that had 8 male parts. And he laughed at me and says, you're not going to get it. You're a freshman, and here's who's going to get it. You know, you got to play politics, you got to do this, you got to do that. Well, when I went and looked at who won the auditions, you know, they were actually, I wrote these things down there. He was right on the money. I was too young to understand that, you know, maybe you should stick with things. So, you know, I stayed in at that point. There was departments were theater and film, radio and TV, speech, so that was communication arts. Mm-hmm. So when I transferred down here, you know, I went into the communication arts part rather than the theater part. Just because I didn't have the patience probably to say it really takes time and energy, and you're not in a small community theater where people know you, and so auditioning is a lot easier. You know, there's real competition. Maybe you're not as good as you thought you were. Mm-hmm. Kind of things that students, you know, young people think about. And I didn't probably have the burning passion, you know, for it. Mm-hmm. For that.
Now, at that point, when you came here and started in the comm arts program, was it in Vilas, or was Vilas still being constructed?
My first year, it was in various places. So I took courses in social science and in Bascom Hall. I mean, I had a film lab that we took in there's a little fourth floor part of Bascom Hall. Hmm. And before they locked the roof out because of a suicide afterwards, we'd crawl out the window and eat our supper on there, because there was an evening class in film lab. So about 6 of us would meet there about 45 minutes before class and sit on the roof of Bascom and eat dinner and watch all the students walk up and down the hill. Hmm. And just sort of dream, you know, like students do at that time. I mean, it's a time when you fall in love with life and you fall in love with other people and, you know, and you fall in love with opportunities and what ifs and, you know, those kind of things. Mm-hmm.
So I told you I was going to ask you, you just mentioned that, you know, you'd have dinner on the top of Bascom Hall. And what places on campus, or were there places on campus or off campus where you would dine?
The Rathskeller was, you know, everyone dined at, I mean, you know, you'd go, and there was a cafeteria, lakefront cafeteria. It was different, you know, you'd go through the line, and there was this woman who, you know, you want waffles today? Oh, hi, how are you, honey? She knew you. So breakfasts were definitely lakefront cafeteria. You know, burger and a beer were definitely, and it was 18-year drinking age at that time. a beer. So, and then it switched to alcohol later, but the Union, you know, you could get beer, so you could get a brat and a hamburger and different things there. Rennebaum's had all lunch counters, and those were like great 99-cent breakfasts, because I worked, and I knew, you know, I mean, I worked right near one of those, so I could eat and go to work right away. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of bars on State Street that were real popular that I didn't attend all that much. You know, the pub people went to, but that sort of freaked me out. The Knicks up near the Orpheum is still around. Mm-hmm. That was a great place because you could buy a sandwich for 90 cents, a beer for a quarter, and go across the street for a movie and for 10 bucks, and then be able to go back and have a beer, take someone out for a date and buy her a sandwich and two beers and go to a movie and still have change left over. And that was, you know, that was my weekend allocation of big money to spend. You know, represented 5 hours of work. You know, that was a lot. Mm-hmm. There was another bar that closed down that we went to a lot on State Street, but that had food, I can't remember. The Copper Grid or the Amber Grid, the one on University Avenue, had a lot of food. And the faculty, so I started working, and I had a girlfriend who worked on campus. So when I came back in the spring of, let's see, what was that? So that would have been, what, 71? 72 maybe, yeah. Because I was just becoming a junior.
Yes.
In the spring. So January. So when I came back there, my girlfriend was working in a lab sifting sand for a power plant study. You know, what's the outflow going to do to the beach erosion downstream from the nuclear power plant, either at Kewaunee or Point Beach? I can't remember which one. And this hippy-dippy clothing store I was working on State Street was going out of business. And so her professor asked what I did. And so we'd meet. Actually, he'd take the whole lab out. Friday afternoons, about 3:30. So I met him at the bar. Because the faculty would go with the grad students and the students who worked in the lab, and they'd have beers, and then almost like informal seminars. Because you could drink when you were 18. And there was not very concerned about is something inappropriate going to happen or something, as there might be now. I mean, the culture, I don't think, you know, that's what's going on now. But he found out that my place was going out of business, that I was a communication arts major, and he told me to get a haircut and go talk to a woman who worked for Sea Grant named Melinda Weimer, who wanted a radio program. This actually, that happened in the summer. So I went to talk to him in his office, and he was one of these good old boy professors from down in Texas who had a newspaper article cut out on his office door that said, "Texas judge upholds right to force haircuts on student," or something like that. And then the dress codes were just breaking down in high schools here, and the college didn't have dress codes. So, you know, that's why he told me to get my haircut. Because we were all growing longer, shaggier hair back then, you know, and especially for working for a hippy-dippy clothing store and doing odd jobs. There was a job board on campus that you could pick up odd jobs down at the Union. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'd bartend on weekends for faculty parties. I built someone's a lawn. I put in a lawn for someone. I painted someone's house. I mean, you just looked for any opportunities. But he told me this woman on campus wanted a job, a radio program. And it was an environmental science radio program because Earth Day happened in April 1972. And to go talk to her about it. So, because when I went to his office, you know, I initially thought he'd offer me a sifting sand job and, hey, you know, I'd have a job. So I went to talk to this woman and she said, well, we need an environmental science radio program. And I actually had a radio production class taught by Ordine Ness in communication arts at the time. And I was doing some fake documentaries, you know, because I didn't have an outlet in the radio. Well, when I did come down here and wasn't a student, I had for a semester a weekend radio program on the radio station in the dorms under the name of Ricky Levitan, who was a student living in the dorm. because you had to be a student living in the dorm, who fake signed up for me. And so when my girlfriend went to work in the evening, I went and did a 3 or 4 hour radio show in the dorms. When it was just the little dorm station, I'm sure not many people listened to me. So I mean, I, you know, there was fun stuff going on in radio. Documentaries were starting to be done on television, you know, in the late 60s, and you know, beyond the Walt Disney ones, I mean the critical ones. It was a great time. So I took it, I went, and she said we would like a radio program, and the Institute for Environmental Studies is willing to partner, and someone there named Mark Kaufman did a program on a weekend for a half an hour, and maybe that's what you should do, talk to him. And there's a guy at University Communications that we should probably be involved in, and that's Carl Gutnick was the guy's name at the time, because they had a radio news service. And then there was a university industry relations program that dealt with science writing kind of programs. So I went to explore those. Mark Kaufman was a TA in a summer class, and he was just doing this huge multimedia project, and said, hey, and I helped him do that in the summer, multiple 16 millimeter projectors and 35, I mean, movie projectors, 35 millimeter slide projectors, and you'd have five people sitting there clicking and doing, turning on and off, because you didn't have the computer controls we have now, you know, for these courses and stuff like that. So I walked around, and I was told, come back in 2 weeks and give us a proposal. I'm a sophomore. I was looking for a job for $2 an hour. And I went to I walked around campus for a day or two, just wondering, what are you gonna do? So I went to the library, and I found that broadcast yearbook, and I looked at the information for the radio stations in town. And Wisconsin Public Radio was there, so I went and talked to some media people and some campus people. So when I went to news service, Carl Gutnick said to me, in so many words, go away, little boy, you don't know what you're doing. And when I walked out of that office, that was my first meeting, I said, I'm gonna succeed. I really just didn't, I mean, he said, this isn't gonna work. So then I went and talked to a person in town in WHA radio who did production behind the scenes. His name was Bill Brown. And he worked at a radio station to begin with in Manitowoc. And he said, you know something, a half hour is not going to work. No one's going to listen to it on Saturday morning or Sunday morning at the times they put those in. And I know a couple people here. Go talk to a couple people in Madison Community Commercial Radio. And, you know, think about it differently. And here I could we could produce it for you. And here's a budget. And here's some public domain music, and here's possibly a good format. So I went and talked to the top 40 station and the country station in Madison, and they both told me, you know, it ain't gonna work. We'll only take 30 seconds or a minute. You can't really deal with science and environment a minute, but we need public affairs programming. And at that time, there was license requirements for radio stations. In order to have your license, you had to have a certain percentage of programming every day of the week. So when you pledged a license, you said, this is going to be news, this is going to be public affairs, this is going to be public service, this is going to be religion, this is going to be entertainment or talk or whatever your market was. And there was the fairness doctrine, you know, so you didn't have the, if you had one story, you had to have the other story. So they said, we need public affairs programming, and that's hard for us to get. And they were defined, so you looked in the FCC, Federal Communication Commission requirements, and they were defined. And so I said, and public affairs program at that time mostly was dumped in dead hours of audio, I mean of audience listenership. So I said, well, what if we designed a package where we could give you 2 minute chunks of public affairs? And they really said, that's a good idea, but it's not gonna work in our format, but it possibly will work. So I went back and said, let's do a 2 minute program. And at that time, Mark Kaufman was close. I mean, so that my proposal was to do a two-minute program. He was done with that big chunk of this. Segrant said, well, we'll give you a chance. We'll give you 6 months, a budget of $1,500, and you're making $2 an hour. And we want 25 stations by December. Well, I think I told them I could get 25 stations by by the first 6 months, because you had, when you were, I was told when you write a proposal, you had to tell someone what you were going to do, you know, and give them what they want to hear. So they said, okay, you have till January to do this. So between, and that September, July 12th was when it was accepted. And September 12th was the first week we sent out five programs. August, 2 months, we turned around a program. We had 12 stations to begin, and we got those stations by calling them, writing them letters, and going and visiting them. First writing a letter, then calling them shortly thereafter, and then going and visiting them. And you had to contact each station at least 3 times just to get a response, and you had to have a sample tape, and Bill Brown helped me put one together. And some of the stations we mailed them to. And we got our 12 stations, and we did our first programs, and I was the worst writer in the world. So I learned how to write during that time too, because I wrote. But why they kept me there was because I produced it, I conceived it with Mark, I marketed it, I made sure it was distributed, I pretty much was the glue. In conjunction with a partner at the Institute for Environmental Studies at all times, because when it came down to the end, News Service didn't want it, University Industry Relations, it didn't really fit within their thing, but the Institute for Environmental Studies wanted to co-sponsor it. So we ran that program together. So it was a 2-minute program dealing with science and environmental issues at broadcast, ultimately by more than 150 stations when I left in 1988, and it died a few years ago. So it was around a long time. So that was couched at Sea Grant. The Sea Grant Research Program wanted to do that. So here I am now working 20 to 30 hours a week, taking courses, 12 credits a semester and 6 in the summer. I went to Ordine Nest that first when I had the chance for the proposal, and he helped me a lot too, and said, could I not do the assignments that you want, but could I actually develop the test pilot for this program? And he said yes. So then the first semester, I developed an independent study class that was, here's how I'm going to market to 25 stations, and here's the books I'm going to read on marketing, and I'm going to document. That's why I can tell you how many times it took on average. And I documented that, I developed an evaluation tool, and then in the spring semester we did some other things. We did a newspaper series in conjunction with it, and I said, hey, here's another independent study course. And all of a sudden I realized that this place was as incredible as I thought it would be, because you had a lot of opportunities to work. And then I went to the College of Letters and Science Dean's office and said, here are the curricular requirements. I can really do a real radio program. Could you allow this to count for this? So they actually allowed me, with the professor's help, you know, saying that will cover an advanced social science course, you know, even though it may not have been exactly in that, because we showed them why when you're dealing with the science and environment and marketing and business. And, you know, so we really constructed that. And then I realized, well, if you write a one-page proposal to people, or you write something and say, this is what I'm going to do in simple language, and this is how you're going to, and this is what you want, so this is what I'm going to do, and this is how we're going to evaluate it. Well, that's how I survived for 18 years with proposals then, because in the Sea Grant program, we started off with annual proposals, and then they went biennial, and then finally 3-year proposals, you know, for funding. And so I worked at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for my first, you know, from 19, I graduated in December 1973, and I started working January 4th, 1974, and at Sea Grant. And I graduated one semester late, because I dropped out that one semester, checked out Berkeley, if you will, that one semester. And then when I worked at Sea Grant, there were all kinds of opportunities to do more things. And Sea Grant represents a couple of the really fundamental core strengths of the university. I'd say 2 of the 3 ones that really were dominant when I was younger. One, it was interdisciplinary. And UW-Madison is extremely interdisciplinary. And I didn't realize how lucky I was working in an interdisciplinary program until I got into administration and realized how people who came from one program only had that one model to draw from, where I saw so many different ways people did things. So I thought that that also benefited in terms of how do you do things. Mm-hmm. The other hallmark of the C-Grant program was public service, the Wisconsin idea. It was an applied research program. And this was in 1972 when I first started, and it was a young program. It was only started in 1969, modeled after the land grant program, which was huge, you know, 100 years, more than 100 years. I mean, this place is a land grant institution. So this program is a smaller version, you know, to help the United States take advantage of the nation's ocean and Great Lakes resources, because the Great Lakes are inland seas, and other than huge tides, they're very similar in many ways. I mean, they're like oceans. They are inland, you know, seas. So the interdisciplinary part and the Wisconsin idea, and that's why they wanted to support educational programming. And they had a communications section and an advisory services section and the research section. We took research in the communication and advisory services part of it, and advisory services was like extension, and we transferred that to people that were using it. So some of the things I did working for some of the scientists was we developed a computer model program for fishery agencies too. So I was involved in, you know, doing a production of one of the first manuals with computer programming for fishery managers. You know, we did things with the state on how to clean your fish to get Great Lakes salmon and lake trout, to get rid of the PCBs, the fat, and things like that. You know, we did advisories on it. We did a lot of work, you know, dealing with the complex issues of what's the science behind the decisions that resource managers are or aren't using. And there was a lot of environmental stuff going on there, a lot of contaminants in the environment, PCBs, dioxin, aldrin, dieldrin, DDT. You know, in this place, Madison, did seminal research on DDT and eggshell thinning and PCBs and stuff like that. So C-Grant was involved in that, and they wanted to transfer that information in the public service. The third great thing this university is known for, of course, is academic freedom. And, you know, while C-Grant wasn't there, at least the other two things, you know, it was definitely a part of. Am I doing the right what you want out of these? Or?
You certainly are.
Okay.
I mean, you could sort of tell, or I can tell anyway, from the way you're describing your work at C-Grant that it really was a seminal experience for you.
Well, let me tell you why. So I started C-Grant. They know I can't write, and they help. Linda Weimer and the editors at the Institute for Environmental Studies, and the writer we first hired was someone getting a PhD in journalism, worked at the Boston Globe beforehand. I mean, literally looked at me when I took him around and said, "Hey, you're going to be working for me. He's a graduate student. I'm an undergraduate." And said, "Who the hell are you?" You know, broke out laughing. We became great friends. They taught me to write. They didn't say, "This is horrible, kid." They said, "Here's how you got to do it now." So they believed in me, and they knew I could help on the other things. So Linda Weimer, you know, took a risk. And Bob Rogatsky, the director of the program, and Louis Eccles at the time, the associate director, took a risk. But you had to perform. There was accountability, because you had to just apply for a new grant each year. So they told me, "We're going to take the risk. We believe you can do it." Well, that's cool. I mean, that makes me want to do it. Well, then, when I got to C-Grant, even when I was an undergraduate for 3 semesters and a couple of summers, they had a retreat, and they knew I'd needed money. I was paying for my college, and so they invited me and my girlfriend up to cook at Kemp Lab while they were developing what was a C-Grant program into a C-Grant college program. Now, that status gave it more status within the university. I don't know exactly how, but it was like a maturation of the funding. If you were a program in the country, you were good. When you got to be a college program in the country, you were of a higher status. Madison was one of the top programs, so we were moving in that direction. So I'm preparing food, and this was cool. This is where Bob Rogatsky and the C-Grant program was really nice. if you're cooking, you're not going to do the dishes. All the scientists and the resource managers from the DNR, people from cities and counties, state planning agencies that were looking at what is Sea Grant doing with and for the state and how, because it had a one-third state fund match requirement. So there was strong state involvement in the program. So they had a 3-day retreat. So after I got done cooking and that, I went out and Bob Rogotsky, the director, professor of meteorology at the time, the department is now Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, he wanted me to participate. So I saw some really bright, mature scientists and some young, bright people with some political acumen of how you work the federal government, how you work the state government, how you partner with agencies, what are the pitfalls, discussing these with the people, and they developed the core of the program. I didn't realize I was getting a seminar in how you can get things done. And then when I worked at Sea Grant, Bob Rogotsky was really an ultimate professorial type in the sense that he brought a bag lunch every day. So in the basement of our little building, there was a tiny little table in this corner, and we'd sit and eat. And he would talk about why we were doing what we were doing. He would talk about the strategies. He would talk about how these five research projects are combined in order to get the outcome that we're looking for. About how the first, in when you don't understand something, the first time you need to do is really sometimes just your first probe is what are the right questions to ask in order to get to the right questions to find some answers. You know, how do PCBs move through water? How do they move through living organisms? How do they move through sediment back into water? Where do they accumulate? How do they get transported around the world? These were pieces that they were building over time that I was watching, but I got to see how they were looking at that before they put all the pieces together with a lot of top quality faculty on campus now, you know, that created new paradigms in science. So I really got a seminar on how an extramural funded program works. And that during the time I worked at Sea Grant, the first few years, I also picked up a master's degree in science journalism. I didn't pick up the science degree in the first 3 years. I picked up all the courses. And then I went to Mexico and I said, I'm not going to complete my work for some reason. But then, about 9 years later, I was called from the University of Minnesota, and they said, we'd like you to run our communications program at the University of Minnesota Duluth for Sea Grant. And I said, well, that's cool. How many people? Well, one, you know, what's the budget? And it was like almost nothing. And I had 9 people, counting students, working for me at the time, and $300,000 budget. And they said, the minimum requirement is a master's. So I completed my master's that semester, because I said, I don't want a door closed. Just don't have a master's for a job that's less, you know, than what I have. Also, I was, while I worked at Sea Grant, I went to work at Louisiana State University for a couple of months and produced a handbook of coastal law with them, and they wanted to recruit me. And I did a couple of weeks in Rhode Island and Hawaii because they were looking too, because their programs, their Sea Grant programs that were connected to their universities in many ways, were looking to upgrade their programs. And so, you know, Madison was one of the top programs, so it was easy to be, you know, in a network of 32 programs around the country. It's pretty easy to be pulled in, you know, for a look-see.
Was that all contract stuff? I mean, would they contract you to work for X number of months?
You know, what I did is, for the 2-week things, those are just trades. You know, I'm going to help them on something. I'm evaluating a program for them while they're looking at what I can bring to their program. Mm-hmm. 2 months, I took a leave of absence and Louisiana State University paid me. You know, for that, yes. I mean, I basically cut a deal and Bob Rogotsky was always favorable for it. Now, Linda Weimer, who was head of the communications, moved up to Bascom and became director of University News Service sometime in this period. Probably in 1980 or somewhere around there, I can't remember for sure. But I was also then offered that job at Louisiana State University, a job at Louisiana State University that also was half-time faculty with a chance for tenure, and to run their communication and advisory service program. And the place was really nice and everything, but I didn't want to go down there because I had three kids in school. And the environment to me was too many petrochemical plants. It's called Chemical Alley, that part of the Mississippi River. The prejudice was more open than it was in the Midwest here, you know, so you were confronting a lot of that stuff regularly. So while I was considering that, the actual week I had to make a decision, Bob Rogatsky offered me the directorship of the communications sub-program here on campus. So then I stayed, you know, here. And then this is important because you said, how did I ever get to Bascom or, you know, get into the provost office or news service? In 1988, Linda Weimer gave me a call and said, I think there's a job you'd be interested in. And again, Linda was director of news service at the time and had been my director at university at Sea Grant, and or my boss initially, and then I filled in for her position. She is very a good person to work for. 75% love and 25% hate, but really challenged me and gave me opportunities. You know, we did so many good things and so many little grants. I didn't say this, but while I was working I found out you could take independent study courses. I found out you can get, with reasonable arguments in dean's offices, you know, this course can still accomplish the requirements for your curriculum. Then I found out you could write these little grants, you know, and so each year at Sea Grant, I had a goal. I want to get three extramural grants. I want to learn the budget better. I want to start making more revenue with partnerships, you know. So I set myself some goals to do that. So I got a lot of small other grants and built some partnerships and knowledge myself. Also, during the Earthwatch radio program, I had an entree. I'd like to come and talk to you about your research, so we're doing a radio program. And a lot of scientists said to me, 2 minutes? Think again. And I impressed the hell out of them because, you know, I always source checked my stuff. So we weren't independent. I mean, it was directed writing. We didn't have mandates from on high that you will say this. But working for Sea Grant, I definitely had to make sure there were enough subjects covered that dealt with oceans and Great Lakes, and that way partnering with the Institute for Environmental Studies gave us the breadth to cover everything under that program. But so I had met a lot of people on campus, done a lot of outreach stuff, done stuff at the state fair with the DNR, you know, showing how research was done, like I said, how to clean fish with our advisory service agents. You know, we put those publications together with them. So Linda said, there's a job opportunity in Bascom and you'd want to come up with. And at that time, there was an Office of Outreach Development and a Division of University Outreach that dealt with the continuing education part of campus that's program revenue under so-called 104 funds. But these were all part of staff and faculty that were brought in when University Extension was merged. I mean, excuse me, when the system merger happened. Extension was with Madison, and then the merger happened, and there were separate entities. That didn't work as much. There was a presidential advisory group on Extension. These things then came into different, Milwaukee and Madison got the most employees, different universities got proportionally small numbers because they're smaller base to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so there was almost a second class of faculty and staff, you know, the integrated faculty and staff. And that was in the outreach development part. And then there was that director of that public information office, which Linda Weimer wanted me to apply for, also had a 25% appointment with the University News Service. Because Joe Corey, Jim Churchill, Peg Geisler, Howard Martin, who were all in the core of that outreach development team. Howard was the dean of university outreach. Joe Corey was associate vice chancellor for academic affairs, but the director of that office. Peg Geisler, I don't know her title, but she was critical. Jim Churchill was the budget man. and you just spectacular. You know, you have to work your budget people, they have to work you. So every year, I working from a research program, would give them a annual report, by actually quarterly report, and then an annual budget request or equipment. We had to go for capital equipment, and I was running a production shop, so I had to show them why we needed what we did. So I had good training from Sea Grant because I had to apply for it. I had to justify everything. I wanted to learn that. My mentors at Sea Grant, Dan Markline, was the budget guy there, was helped teach me all this stuff. You know, really set me up well for succeeding. And then Jim Churchill was just another mentor on campus who, you know, would show how and why, along with Joe Corey, how to move things along. And then, well, they wanted to partner with University News Service at the time because, well, it was Public Affairs University. Well, you know, sorry, the different names. And so I worked with Linda in that office as an assistant director, and I did some weird stuff. I did campus coordination of films and commercial production. I did some of the radio and TV spots, or the broadcasts of football and basketball games, the institutional ones, with a budget, I might add, of $3,000, which was totally inadequate. We just, you know, the institution did not put much resources into it at that time, you know. You had to realize that at some point we came from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We were so good, we didn't need to, you know, show our light and everything like that. So there was a change over my career where you needed to show what you were doing more. You know, how a public institution operates in the public funding arena has changed too, as politics have changed. So, you know, we definitely had to be more accountable and show that. But so I worked in university communications on some broader campus initiatives and in outreach development on the support for the continuing education operation, including production of catalogs and brochures for a lot of the units. There were a couple of huge ones that did their own engineering professional development in the Management Institute and the Business School. Now Executive Education in the Business School had their own staffs to do it. But we tried to coordinate and work together. So again, going from Sea Grant, which was a system program administered in Madison that gave me the freedom to talk to people on campus in many areas because I was going to help them advance their knowledge. I was going to provide some information to the public on what we were doing. Then I went into where in every school or college that had a continuing education program, I start working with every school and college as well in that area. Again, that's Wisconsin idea. Again, that's outreach in some areas. Much of it is very decentralized on our campus. So you end up working with networks of people over time. And when the Office of Outreach Development, Division of University Outreach, I moved the production shop from the Office of Outreach Development Program and Information Office into the Division of University Outreach, which became Division of University Outreach and Summer Session and Intercollegiate Programs, and then it became Division of Continuing Studies. But I moved the production office into that unit because it was primarily serving that unit. Why should it be sitting in a direct budgetary, you know, outlet in the provost office? It should be in a unit where it's supporting every, you know, it's still doing a cross-campus thing, where when budget problems came down the pike and when you started looking at what's the program revenue mix here, we can't get money to support all this stuff. So what is the program revenue mix? It's better to put it into a unit where it is strategically critical for that dean to have a good support unit. And so I worked with the dean and Joe Corey in the Office of Outreach Development and Jim Churchill to transfer that over. So I still kept my position in the Office of Outreach Development, which was still in the Provost Office. So, you know, technically speaking, from 1988 through my retirement, I worked for the Provost Office. You know, the last several years directly reporting to the Provost, but not in the first few years, although you did stuff with some of the Provost staff and all that. Mm-hmm. So I worked in those areas a number of years, tried to make a lot of changes, and you know, there's a lot of things that we did that still lasts today, looking at, you know, how we do our databases and mailings, and some of the problems still exist today too. You know, it's hard to move big organizations. So when the, and I don't know if I'm going, you know, I don't know if I'm missing things or not, but the I was asked in 1987 to present to a committee what my qualifications would be to run the sesquicentennial celebration for the university. And that I think we'll talk about that later, because I have some notes at home, and that was extremely strategic on the campus level, and that would be, you know.
Right.
But when I came up to Bascom to work in 1988, significantly, Donna Shalala had just come in there. So now, I'm in the University Communication, the University News and Public Affairs, which works for them, and within my first 6 months, I staffed Donna Shalala on a couple of trips. And then I worked with the Alumni Association and with the foundation on these activities. And that's because Donna was meeting people that she may ask gifts for later. So I prepare little fact sheets. We're going to the Fox Valley. I have to cough. I'm sorry.
Yep, that's
Linda Weimer had me staff a couple of the trips in areas I knew about. So when we went to the Fox Valley in Green Bay, where there's a lot of research I knew about, and we went up in northern Wisconsin and showcased things we were doing with the Native American tribes and the DNR and the Center for Limnology, she had me staff that. So I'd have to write up little notes, and I knew a busy administrator is only going to look at 2 pages maximum. So you have a little subhead, important people, name, this is what this person's business, here's what they've done, here's the gifts they've given or not. She would look at that just like that. She's such a quick study. Almost looked like she didn't read it. Just looked at it and had most of the information in her head. So so then I got to see the workings of the provost office, the chancellor's office, various dean's offices around campus, which was sort of a fun thing to do for a non-faculty member in a rather supporting role, you know. And that's important because that's where I bumped into people like John Wiley, who later on became dean of the graduate school, provost, and chancellor. And that's also why it's important, believe it or not, Joe Corey, when I worked in outreach development, asked me to join a softball team. And he had people from all over the university on that softball team. So I got to meet people from legal services, people from physical plant, painters, electricians, to other faculty members, to police. And all of a sudden you realize, well, when you look at this place here, what makes things happen is relationships. And then a strategic reason to have a relationship. So I was able to develop a lot of relationships. And I actually worked with Howard Martin and the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Letters, and Arts, and the business school's arts master's program. And we funded a student, a master's student, to look at what made relationships work between the university and the community in arts and humanities. And that proved, number one, the relationship. Then the budget and the reason for working together were behind that. But even if you had a reason to work together budgetarily or mandated legislatively, it didn't work as good as if you had a good relationship with someone. So I was lucky because most of the time that I worked with people, I ended up not having conflicts, but we were working together to solve something. So I developed a bunch of good relationships. And I think that's why later on I was asked to come up and, you know, present myself for the sesquicentennial coordinator, which would really make me work for the right. chancellor directly.
And I think that's, I mean, I think this might be a good yeah. stopping point. I mean, we're over an hour.
Yeah.
And then we can start with, we can go back in time to 87 to the, you know, presenting your credentials to run the sesquicentennial and then sort of the path that gets you to be the leader of that.
Yeah.
And then we'll sort of move forward from there.
Right, because a couple of other initiatives that are probably worth talking about would be the role, you know, John Wiley's RWJ project, the cluster hire program, you know, beside the sesquicentennial
right.
and the Baldwin Endowment.
Right.
And the reason I'm saying that is because all those are institutional, not me things. Those are institutional things that are big and still continuing and or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other, you know, critical people to talk about them, but I have some.
And then I think the other thing, too, is we'll give you space at the beginning, you know, as you reflect over the course of the day and get your notes. You said you had some notes together for the sesquicentennial.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll get you, give you some space, too, that if there are other things you want to talk about sort of pre-sesquicentennial that come into your mind, if you want to write them down, we could certainly get them on the record in the follow-up interview.
Well, they're so minor, but I'll tell you this. One of the cool things I did was a real small little Great Lakes Great Maps exhibit. I was at an International Association for Great Lakes Research Conference in Milwaukee, Golden Mayer Library at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And one of the units there houses the collection of the U.S. Geological Society maps, atlases, and globes that was originally out in New York. Mm-hmm. There was a guy named Christopher Baruth who was the curator. And there was an announcement, or there was something in the program that said, hey man, if you want to go over and look at some early maps of the Great Lakes, they're here. Well, I went over there, and the first thing I picked up was a 1688 map of the Great Lakes. And so I talked to him and Margaret Bogue. Margaret Bogue was a historian in Extension. And we took 25 of those maps and framed them and sent them around the state and had an exhibit that showed the art and technology of map making and the history of the settlement of the Great Lakes region through 25 maps. So you started off with really that early map showing the United States, and then, you know, this map of the was in an atlas that was the first map that showed the Mississippi River that actually ended up where the Mississippi River ends up, because the first map that showed the Mississippi ended up where the Rio Grande entered. Mm-hmm. You know, so this was, so, you know, you're sitting there and we framed these and sent those around. So, you know, and that was before the map thieves hit all the libraries and came with their razor blades and cut out all the maps and all the books and made fortunes, you know, mm-hmm. tearing them apart. And, I mean, you know, these are the kind of things that I don't think people realize, you know. Another thing, and you don't need to include this, but this was so cool. In part of my film project, how did I get to know Frank Cook, director of archives, and how did we have such a good relationship during the sesquicentennial, beside the fact that it really fit what the archives wanted, you know, a history. There was a Japanese film crew that was looking at the history of basketball in Japan, and there was a graduate student over here from Japan who took basketball to Japan, and that's how it started. And he worked for the team, the basketball team here. Archives, we went to archives, because we heard, someone said, hey, I called up and they said, sure. They pulled out a time card, handwritten, that this guy had filled in from like 1899 or whatever it was. They went nuts filming this little card like this, but then I realized archives, I mean, this university has a lot. And I knew the State Historical Society has a lot because we have given them our Earthwatch tapes early on, but I had, for one of my papers, found the original three boxes of notes and resource materials for the guy who wrote the Disney version book. And in there were the personal phone numbers of some of the photographers that did Disney work and all that. Mm-hmm. So I was able to do some papers and do firsthand source research, talking to some of the photographers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did you really push those lemmings into the sea? Mm-hmm. How was it when you burnt the arboretum, you know, for the Vanishing Prairie? I mean, you know, and that this place is incredible. Another thing, when I was working we were trying to put a database together of the kind of things we're doing for K through 12 resources. The director of the library, Ken, come on, what's his last name?
Frazier.
Louise Robbins at the time, graduate of School of Library. And Terry Millar in the graduate school for the, what was that graduate program? Oh God, where they had graduate students working on real life issues to K through infinity or whatever it was, program. We all worked together, got a graduate student, had him do a database to develop, you know, how we could put our K through 12 resources and tie them to curricular requirements, state standards and all that kind of stuff. I've never gone to people in libraries. Another thing that I didn't tell you, I read books a lot when I grew up, and I had two influential high school teachers beyond the one I told you about. Mm-hmm. In my junior and senior year in high school, the librarian at Preble High School had a separate room in the back where she kept all the books she was afraid to put out front. I came into the library all the time and checked out books, so she asked me, would you read these and let me know what you thought? So I had all these books that were being, quote, banned. And I mean, some of them were a joke. I mean, I tell her, this should be out here. I mean, we need to read this stuff, you know. I don't know why public would be concerned. So this librarian opened my eyes to maybe there's a back room to library, you know, and you can get more resources. And that's when I think I found out that reference librarians can help you a lot too. And I had a writing literature teacher, Ken Wall, in Green Bay, Preble High School. And I painted houses with him in the summer one year. But he asked me to be in a play because they really needed a male part to it. But when I did work for him, he made me move it up a higher level in my critical thinking. And when I told him I was going to be a high school teacher because I thought that'd be neat, he challenged me to think beyond that. You know, he challenged me, and then he kept in touch with me for my first 4 or 5 years of high school, college. I'd stop back when I went to visit my parents and have a beer with them. And he always encouraged me and said, you can do more. You know, so I think a couple of high school teachers like that, you know, that tell you you're really capable of doing something, and mm-hmm. are really important. So anyway.
All right. Well, let's conclude then. So yep. This concludes the first interview with Peyton Smith. Peyton, thank you very much for your time.